Take the bass line out. Uh-huh.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a prelude to the next Hardwood Knox podcast. I am Dan Favalli, coming at you very quickly without my awesome co-host, Andy Bailey. I'm doing this prelude because we're wrapping up the part two of our top 25 lineups for this NBA regular season. And we already recorded today, but while I was working out, no less. I thought it was safe to work out, and it was not. That's not a humble brag. It's literally just my therapy, but news broke that Joel Embiid, this is from Sham Sharania over at Yahoo Sports, tweeted, Philadelphia star Joel Embiid will undergo surgery to repair an orbital fracture of his left eye and will be out indefinitely. The Sixers soon after tweeted, or actually just beforehand tweeted out, after suffering an injury at the 11:50 mark of the second quarter of the Sixers' win against the Knicks on Wednesday night, Joel Embiid was initially evaluated in the locker room and later taken to Jefferson Hospital for further evaluation and testing. Immediately following the injury, Embiid was assessed for a concussion, was asymptomatic at that time, and passed the NBA's locker room concussion assessment tool. That's a hell of a mouthful. They continued. However, he later began experiencing symptoms, has since been diagnosed with a concussion, and has been placed in the NBA's concussion protocol. Embiid also underwent a CT scan, which revealed an orbital fracture of his left eye. Surgery will be performed in the coming days to address the orbital fracture, and further updates will be provided as appropriate. Finally, we have this from ESPN.com's Zach Lowe, saying, pending the results of surgery, Embiid could return to play in 2 to 4 weeks, per league source. First round, obviously in some jeopardy. He is referring to the first round of the NBA playoffs. Andy and I go on to address this injury a little bit in the podcast itself, but we talk about it as if it's a hypothetical, so we just want to provide some up-to-date things here. The Sixers, let me start here. This sucks. It's awful. It's terrible. No good. Really bad. Unfair. Just the worst. Injuries are the worst. You look at all the stars we've lost this year, either for the season, when you look at Cousins, Gordon Hayward. Now we're seeing guys like Jimmy Butler, Kyrie Irving have to stay on the shelf. Kawhi Leonard doesn't look like he's going to play again this year either. Kevin Love's been shuffling in and out of Cleveland's rotation. It's injuries, they suck. We should ban them. We should look into that. That's a hoop idea. Let's ban injuries. The Sixers, though, trying to tackle this so soon into the prognosis, they're going to be fine immediately. They have the easiest schedule in the NBA remaining, according to playoffstatus.com. So while you look at this injury and you immediately look toward their game against the Cavaliers coming up next Friday, April 6th, that's the one that seems like it's going to determine the number three seed in the Eastern Conference. The Cavaliers have a half game hold over the Sixers because they're one win in front of them. The winner of that game will more likely than not go on to get the NBA's number three seed, and the Sixers probably aren't going to win that game now without Joel Embiid. It's that simple. But the panic really isn't necessary at this point, just because Philly has shown some signs in recent weeks that it can survive without Embiid on the floor. And you look at the season's overall numbers. With Embiid on the court, the Sixers are outscoring opponents by 11.6 points per 100 possessions, which is just absolutely ridiculous. When he is off the court, however, they're getting hammered by a minus 3.9 points per 100 possessions. It's actually been worse. That 3.9 really isn't that bad. And fun fact, Robert Covington has the lowest not on the court net rating, off court net rating. The Sixers are a minus 4.5 without him on the floor. When you look at since just February 1st, though, the Sixers are a ridiculous plus 15.2 points per 100 possessions when Embiid is on the floor, compared to a plus 0.8 points per 100 possessions when he's off. And we're talking about nearly a 540-minute sample size. That's a big deal. And something else to consider, too, specifically Ben Simmons and Robert Covington playing together, they're a plus 13 points per 100 possessions without Embiid since February 1st. Those are all great signs. Another thing on top of that to consider, two of the Sixers' three most used lineups this year do not include Joel Embiid. And if we isolate those five-man units since February 1st, we find out that they've actually been faring even better than normal. Since February 1st, Philly's second most used lineup is Marco Bellinelli, Robert Covington, Amir Johnson, Dario Saric, Ben Simmons. They have an offensive rating of 114.9 and a defensive rating of 88.3. That's a plus 26.6 net rating. Again, absurd. It's only an 82-minute sample, but we're talking about 15 games they've appeared in. That's a fairly big deal. Their third most used lineup over this span has made 8 appearances totaling 53 minutes. Again, another small sample size. It is Robert Covington, Amir Johnson, TJ McConnell, Dario Saric, Ben Simmons. They have a 104 offensive rating, not great, but a 97.2 defensive rating. That's a plus 6.8 net rating. So the Sixers are finding ways to survive without Embiid, and that's huge. You also look at Markel Fultz's return, and he's the one who collided with Embiid that kind of didn't will this injury into existence, but that's just some painful irony right there. Markel Fultz misses 58 consecutive games, returns, plays fairly well, but in the second game of his return, he is part of Joel Embiid's latest injury. Now that you have him, though, that's an additional shot creator that you didn't get in really Ersan Ilyasova, although he can do some tricky stuff with the ball. You didn't get that in Marco Bellinelli, even though he likes to fall in love with some junky pull-up twos. If he's a guy who can really jumpstart your offense with face-ups, run pick-and-rolls, just pass the ball, that's kind of an element that Embiid himself didn't even provide. He can face up, and he's a pretty good passer out of the post, but he'll turn the ball over a lot. He's going to look to score first and foremost. Markel Fultz is already looking to dish before he shoots now. Just having him, that will help with your bench-heavy units in theory. We're talking about a guy who's played in 6 games as of this recording. He's a rookie. We can't expect the world of him. Now that you have him back, though, certainly for the rest of the regular season, you should be fine. Just looking at the Sixers' upcoming schedule, we know it's the easiest in the league. They play at Atlanta on Friday. Then it's at Charlotte on Sunday. Then they host Brooklyn on Tuesday. Then they play Detroit on Wednesday in Detroit. Then they have the Cavaliers in Philly on Friday. Sunday, they host the Dallas Mavericks. That's April 8th it takes us to. Tuesday, April 10th, they're back at the Atlanta Hawks. And then they close up the season on Wednesday, April 11th versus the Milwaukee Bucks. If Embiid was to miss exactly 2 weeks, he would still miss the duration of the regular season. The bigger concern is, will he be back in the first round? 4 weeks from now puts him at April 29th, and that would be, or late April, excuse me, I spoke too soon. That puts the first round in jeopardy, and can they win a playoff series without him? That would be a huge question. I would say, depending on their opponent, yes. There's nobody in the East that they could face outside of Cleveland, really, that's going to leave them quaking. The Toronto Raptors have been fantastic this year. Maybe that's the team you fear the most behind any LeBron James squad, but the Sixers don't have to worry about facing them in the first round unless they drop all the way down to 8th, and they're not going to relinquish a 5-game hold to the Milwaukee Bucks. And they don't even really have to worry about facing Cleveland. Let's assume they don't get the 3 seed. They would have to drop to number 6, and right now they have a 3-game edge over the Washington Wizards, who don't yet have John Wall back. So you're looking at a first-round matchup. Let's say, at worst, even if they fall to 7th, you could match up with a Celtics team that might not have Kyrie Irving, and that's going to be fine. Take that if you go and you're just locked into number 4, or you're just locked in to number 5, then you're looking at a matchup with the Pacers or the Wizards or maybe the Heat, depending how things shake out. Right now, I would say the most likely scenario would be that the Sixers still somehow end up snagging the number 3 seed, in which case they're going to end up playing the Heat or the Wizards. Two good teams, but I would say still beatable when you look at how the Sixers have been able to defend specifically at points without Joel Embiid on the court. Their offense has generally not been great, but you look at their defensive returns, and when you have Simmons and Roko, And even Dario Saric has become a little bit of an underrated defender. The same is always held true for Ersan Ilyasova. Markel Fultz is going to give you some extra length and size there as well. You put all those pieces together and your defense is most likely going to be fine. Amir Johnson as well. We just talked about one of those non-Embiid lineups, that one that includes Amir Johnson, Saric, Simmons, and Covington. That group can switch so much in an understated fashion. That'll be good for the Sixers. If they don't have a 3 seed, they're going to be in 4-5, in which case they're looking at mostly the same opponents. My guess would be they'd end up playing the Pacers, who would take over the number 4 spot. That's a winnable series as well without Embiid. The Pacers have been really good this year. Their defense has picked up. They have one of the best defenses in crunch time. Victor Oladipo's hit some ridiculously tough shots. Darren Collison has been good. Corey Joseph has been good. Bogdanovich has been good for them. Miles Turner is just an offensive beast, and not having Embiid on the court when he's going to be playing, that's something that could hurt Philly. At the same time, the luxury of what the Sixers do, Ben Simmons, basically their point guard, he can still defend Miles Turner for the most part. This injury means something. If we're looking ahead to will he be out for round two, do the Sixers need to be the number 3 seed to really have a chance at making the Eastern Conference Finals or making the NBA Finals? Maybe they do, because if you're the number 3 seed, you pretty much guarantee that you wouldn't have to face Cleveland until the Eastern Conference Finals. And if you did, they would have to go through Toronto first. So there's a chance you wouldn't even necessarily need to meet them to get to the NBA Finals. There is value in that, and that's certainly in jeopardy. But if he's going to be back by the end of the first round, if he's going to be back before the first round is over, this is still a team that's a threat to make the Eastern Conference Finals and maybe even potentially come out of the conference if something breaks right for them. Maybe Cleveland just isn't good and they don't have a defensive switch and LeBron himself isn't enough to will them. I honestly don't know there, but looking at them still making it out of the first round, I think they'll still do it. I honestly think they'll still do it. And that's a huge silver lining and a testament to the way this team has developed. They've been better without Joel Embiid. They're forging an identity without him. This will put that to the test. I'm not saying that's a blessing in disguise. It could certainly help them long term, but it's not all bad provided he sticks to that timeline and no further complications arise. And to kind of close, if he was going to get injured again, at least it's not a foot or back issue. It's just kind of this freak, unrelated accident that isn't the byproduct of something that's been reoccurring or already happened in the past. With that, we're going to get you back to the top 25 lineups, because now this is officially a fairly long podcast. But just remember that some of the things we're saying, spoiler, the Sixers are involved in the top 10 lineups. But just remember that everything we said was recorded before this, before the news broke that Embiid was going to be out indefinitely, most likely 2 to 4 weeks. I hand it over to me again.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox Podcast. I am Dan Favalli, coming at you, as always, with my super-duper, incredibly esteemed, awesome times awesome, spectaculario, fantabulous, fully functioning MacBook-clad Andy Bailey.
Well, it's not fully functioning. I still don't have a webcam.
Oh, good. So then my broken screen from this morning, that's going to run me probably like a grand to fix. We're in good company then.
Yeah, hopefully they actually give you a working webcam. When they replace mine, I didn't have one, and I've just never bothered to go back. So whatever.
Oh, wonderful. As you can tell, I'm still salty about it. I was not happy when it happened early this morning.
I do not blame you.
It gets to a point, though, if it costs, when you have to, like, pay, my MacBook's about, like, the MacBook Pro is, like, almost 3 years old, because I still have Apple Care on it. If you have to spend $1,000 or more, like, to fix something, because I know accidents aren't going to be covered under Apple Care, at that point, I'm like, I know it's going to be twice as much or more to get the same new model, but, like, putting $1,000, $1,200 into something that's 3 years old is just so frustrating.
Don't you get a tax write-off for your computers?
Yeah, we can do that, but it would have been nice if this happened in 2017 as opposed
to. There you
go.
Yeah,
and that's even better. So the Apple Genius Bar, or whatever it's called now, didn't have an appointment available until Saturday, which is also when I'm going to do my taxes beforehand. So that's going to be like a super expensive day for me. It's going to be awesome.
You must have like the busiest Apple store in America.
We have, there's
the
a couple
perks of
around.
Living in New York.
Yeah, it's just, and there are a few around me, but there was the other one, didn't have one until Monday. And Apple's just always, I don't know if it's the same by you, but their store's just always crazy when you go in there.
Well, I would have to drive like an hour and a half to get to an Apple store, so I don't know that struggle.
Ah, the Wyoming effect.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Enough about my 2018 problems, because that's such a 2018 problem. My MacBook isn't perfect. We're back. We're here to wrap up our top 25 lineups of the NBA season. Before we do, I would like to thank everyone for getting us to the 100 rating benchmark on iTunes. We very much appreciate that. And now we're going to ask you to continue to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. We would really just like to have as many reviews as Stephen Curry made three-pointers when he set the NBA record. Was that 408? Is it 409?
402, I think.
402. Yeah, so now 402 is our next goal. So if you guys could get cracking on that, that'd be spectacular. Just please take the 10, 15 seconds out of your day, go over to iTunes, search Hardwood Knox, rate it, review it, and definitely subscribe to it if you haven't already. And we are not above you stealing people's phones, family, friends, frenemies, strangers, and doing the same for them. Also, we still have the promo code at NBA Math. Get you 15% off at the NBA Math shop, where we have some great designs for you to look at. The promo code is Benno, B-E-N-O, NBAMath.com/shop. That'll get you 15% off. A lot of people have not been using it lately, I've been told, and they tried to rip it away from us, but I wouldn't let them, Andy. So let's get that thing rolling. And with that, just to remind everyone, before we get into these final 10 lineups, the formula we used was not super scientific. It just tried to account for point differential and volume. Using cleaning the glass data, we multiplied the number of possessions every lineup played by their net rating, and then we divided by 100 just so it could be a more manageable lineup score. We also made the cutoff 95 possessions played, just because that was slightly below the slowest team's pace in the NBA, and it just feels wrong to give consideration to a unit that has played less than a full game ostensibly together. And so yeah, that's what we went with, and we still ended up with a sample of almost 350 lineups, so I think it was pretty robust. With all of that out of the way, do you want to get us started, Andy?
Absolutely. So should we do a quick, I'll do a super quick recap of 25 through 11.
Oh,
and
if I'm you ready haven't, for this.
If you haven't listened to our breakdown of those, go back into the podcast feed and listen to it, because your life will be so much better after you do that. 25 was Rubio, Mitchell, Ingles, Favors, Gobert from the Jazz. 24 was Drew Holiday, Etuan Moore, Darius Miller, Anthony Davis, DeMarcus Cousins. 23 was Lillard, McCollum, Harkless, Aminu, Nurkic. 22 was Satoransky, Beal, Oubre, Porter, Morris. 21 was Wall, Beal, Porter, Morris, Gortat. 20, Murray, Harris, Chandler, Millsap, Jokic. 19, Murray, Mills. I almost did our abbreviation gap. Danny Green, Kyle Anderson, LaMarcus Aldridge. 18, the New York Knicks, Jarek Jack, Courtney Lee, Tim Hardaway, Porzingis, Cantor. Curry, Klay Thompson, Durant, Draymond, and Pachulia was 17. Walker Batum, Kidd Gilchrist, Williams, and Howard was 16. Wall, Beal, Oubre, Porter, Gortat, 15. Collison, Oladipo, Bogdanovich, Young, Sabonis, 14. Lillard, McCollum, Turner, Aminu, Nurkic, 13. Corey Joseph, Victor Oladipo, Bojan Bogdanovich, Thad Young, Miles Turner was 12. And Eric Bledsoe, Tony Snell, Chris Middleton, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and John Henson was 11. That was much more ambitious than I anticipated it. But
I think you got through it with poise and grace. Nice
thank
job.
You. So that brings us to number 10, and it's the Houston Rockets, who, no surprise that they have a lineup in the top 10. The lineup that it is may be somewhat surprising to some people. James Harden, Eric Gordon, Trevor Ariza, Ryan Anderson, and Clint Capella. They've played 443 possessions together this season, and they have a net rating of 20 for a lineup score of 88.6. Is it at all surprising to you that it's Harden and Gordon and not Harden and Paul, or is this something that you kind of saw coming? It seems like you split up either you split up Harden and Paul and you put either one of them with Gordon and good things happen for Houston. That's just sort of the trend I've noticed all year.
Yeah, and the other thing is Paul has missed a bunch of time. So when look at the possessions that the lineups with him have kind of played, it's not too surprising. I was just a little bit surprised that it was this lineup, although when you look
this
at
it... This is the one they started while in like Paul's first absence, right?
Yeah, and right now, as I'm looking at cleaning the glass, if you sub out James Harden for PJ Tucker and then you sub in Chris Paul for Eric Gordon as well, those two resulting lineups have played the identical number of possessions, 443 each. Huh. And so I think this is just kind of a little bit of a combination of... excuse me, when you sub in PJ Tucker for Eric Gordon, anyway, there's a lineup with Paul in it and PJ Tucker that's played the same number of possessions as this. The net rating just isn't as good because the defense, which I found kind of surprising, wasn't as good because you remove Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson from this lineup and you put in Chris Paul and PJ Tucker, you'd think the defense would get better. Yeah. Eric Gordon hasn't been bad on defense this year, nor has Ryan Anderson, who's been sneaky good in isolation. And when you just look at the spacing and what Gordon can do, he's a guy, not better than Chris Paul, but he's more used to kind of straddling those lines between both on-ball and off-ball scoring. So maybe, particularly at the beginning of the year, he's more of a natural fit beside Harden, and perhaps that's what really does it for them. And I mean, of course, the fact that they have a true shooting percentage over 62 with this unit on the floor. So that's going to help you as well. And Anderson is by far a better spacer than PJ Tucker. I shouldn't say by far, but Anderson camps out like near the half court line.
Yeah, well, that's one of my favorite things about him is it's not just the fact that he shoots threes. It's the fact that he will spot up like 6 or 7 feet behind the line. And that gives you 6 or 7 extra feet of space. So that's I think that's important. I love how much Mike D'Antoni has embraced staggering Harden and Paul, basically to the point where Houston almost never has to play without one of those guys on the floor, at least one of those guys. And lineups like this are certainly helping to make that possible. I thought this would be interesting. So in the minutes that James Harden has played in this lineup, so when he's on the floor with Gordon, Ariza, Anderson, and Capella, he's averaging 25.7 points, 13.1 assists, 5.3 rebounds, and 3.6 threes per 36 minutes.
Holy crap.
26 and 13 are obviously the big takeaways there. So his assist numbers are down this year from last year, and the reason is obvious. He's got to play, you know, a lot of time with a guy who's another big assist person, but there are times when last season's James Harden comes out and maybe even like a souped up version of him, because 13 assists is pretty wild. So he is still one of the game's very, very, very best creators for his teammates. And I think this lineup is good evidence of that.
And two kind of quick notes on that, or I guess one of them kind of deviates, which is why something I'm just a little bit sad about. But Harden and Paul have been absolutely unreal as ISO scorers this year. So when you kind of combine that with what goes into the rest of the lineups, I mean, the Rockets are averaging 1.13 points per isolation possession this year. The Cavaliers led last year in isolation efficiency at 0.99. The Warriors led the NBA in 2015-2016 at 0.93. And if you took...
Who's second right now? Because they've probably got a huge lead this season too, right?
Oh, it is demonstrative. So second place in isolation is the Clippers, and you have to thank Lou Williams for that. And the Raptors, they're theoretically tied at 1.01 points per possession. So that's still...
not even close.
Right, yeah. It's 12-tenths of a point gap, which is more than the gap that separates... Cleveland, or it's about the same that separates Cleveland, which is in about 12th place, from being in second place. So that's kind of nuts to itself. And if you took, though, what the Rockets were scoring in isolation, so let's just say 113 points per 100 possessions, they would still have the best offense in the NBA. That would be the best offense. They have a 113.1 offensive rating overall on the season. So they're literally have the best offense in the league just in isolation.
And they've used over 1,000 isolation possessions too.
That seems like Oklahoma, a lot.
Oklahoma City is second with 848. I'm sure a massive chunk of that is Russell Westbrook, but keep going.
Oh, and I'm sure it's definitely Melo and Paul George at the beginning of the year too, as they were still trying to figure things out. One of the things I lament about this, and I'm not sure if they're just trying to save these lineups, but I love how Houston can look with a non-traditional big on the floor, where you don't have Anderson or Capella, and you use Ariza and Bob Moot. Tucker, Harden, and Paul, that's the most popular one, but you could technically pull Ariza or Paul and throw in Gordon if you want. There are a lot of different things you could do, but their most used lineup that doesn't include a wing has only logged 58 possessions this year. It's Harden.
You mean that doesn't include a big?
Yeah, sorry. And so, and it's played 58 possessions. It's Harden, Gordon, Ariza, and Bob Moot and Tucker. They have a 46.6 net rating. And their offensive rating is 146.6. But 58 possessions is nothing. I'm interested to see whether they're just saving these for the playoffs. And if so, whether that could that almost have an adverse impact on them because they're not necessarily used to playing that way in volume.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there is some risk in sort of saving something like that until the playoffs. Because it would be nice to work out some of the kinks and develop a little bit of chemistry in a group like that. But I wouldn't be surprised if he rolls it out. The other thing is Capella has just been a monster this season. So it's totally understandable for D'Antoni to kind of ride that out throughout the regular season. But I'm with you. I would love to see more lineups that are Harden and Paul or throwing Gordon in there too with three of those super switchy wings and just sort of see how fast and crazy they can play.
And I guess there is something to be said, though, that Capella's kind of like the bridge between more traditional and the most contemporary lineups because he's very mobile for a big and he can hold his own in space. And that's why he's so effective with what he does.
All right, you want to do number nine?
Yeah, let's roll. Number nine. This is the Washington Wizards are back for their third appearance.
This has been like this lineup shows up all the time on my Twitter, so...
And it's the second lineup of theirs that does not include John Wall of the three that have made this list. Thomas Satoransky, Bradley Beal, Otto Porter, Markieff Morris, and Marcin Gortat. They've played 895 possessions, 9.9 net rating for a lineup score of 88.61. They just edged out, I don't know if you said Houston's lineup score, 88.6. Talk about close.
I was just thinking right when you said 88.61, I thought, is there another one that's that close? And I don't think I remember one.
And it could actually, so we obviously made these results, we ran these results at the beginning of the week, so there's a chance that it has changed.
Yeah, they shifted it a little bit. But
It actually doesn't look like that Houston lineup has logged any more possessions, according to Cleaning the Glass, so maybe it wouldn't have. This lineup, it makes sense. I just don't know how much use for it there is when John Wall is healthy, because you're not going to put Satoransky with all those starters. And then maybe you could just let Wall run with the bench if you really wanted, not bring him off the bench, but you know what I mean? Kind of make him
like make Satoransky come in 6 minutes into the game or something.
Yeah. And then let Wall go nuts kind of as the, just as the primary alpha with a second unit heavy lineup. And maybe that works because when you look at the Wizards lineup splits, there've been points where putting Satoransky with all bench guys has worked, but there's also been points where they've been statistically terrible. Scott Brooks seems very reluctant to use Markieff Morris in that role. Otto Porter, he's interesting to me. I think he can do more as a ball handler than we've seen, but he's just not used to it, and you can tell when he plays that way. They experimented heavily with that, it seemed, at the beginning of the year, using Kelly Oubre Jr., and that just never worked. So maybe putting Wall in that role, maybe this is kind of the pathway to making that happen, but I honestly don't know because Brooks has never seemed like he's been that kind of coach that's going to stagger the minutes of his two best players to that degree. But this lineup, assist rate of 69.3, true shooting percentage 60.4, which is solid. They play at a very slow pace, which again isn't surprising given all the creators they have within this lineup. Offensive rebounding percentage of 25.6. That's nuts.
That's surprising, yeah. I like this lineup a lot. Like I said, I've talked about it a bunch this year. I I don't think Thomas Satoransky is a better individual basketball player than John Wall. But I think there is something to be said about the fit. Just the fact that he doesn't sort of dominate the ball before he gets an assist, the fact that he can space out and force defenses to pay attention to the three-point line when Bradley Beal has the ball or when Otto Porter has the ball. I just feel like the ball maybe moves a little bit more with this lineup. It is really interesting to think about. I was listening to a different podcast. It was Andy Larson's Salt City Hoops the other day. What kind of trade value do you think, not that Washington would trade John Wall, but what kind of trade value do you think he has considering the fact that they're going to be paying him, what is it, $45 million?
Is it, wow, talk about topical. I just wrote something about this before we hopped on.
Oh, wow.
what would you say to this deal? And just for the record, that John Wall entering his age 32 season is going to have a player option that is worth around $46.9 million.
Wow.
He isn't turning that down. So if you have John Wall, you have him through 2022, 2023. And
imagine if the cap stays like somewhat level too. You're committing like 40% of your salary cap to John Wall.
Yeah, and so this was the trade I came up with. It's a three-teamer. The Brooklyn Nets would receive Jared Dudley, Jason Smith, both of whom are expiring. So we're talking offseason, by the way. And they would get the Phoenix Suns' first-round pick this year. The Suns would get Jan Mahimi, John Wall, and Toronto's first-round pick from Brooklyn. Washington gets Damari Carroll, Tyson Chandler, Spencer Dinwiddie, and Josh Jackson.
Tell me the first team again.
The Nets are getting...
Okay.
Nets are effectively doing is they're eating... Jared Dudley's expiring, so they're just kind of swallowing Smith and Dudley while giving up Dinwiddie and Toronto's first-round pick to get Phoenix's first-round pick, which is going to be in the top five. You could even say that maybe the Nets need to give up more, whether it's Caris LeVert or Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, which would certainly work. And then what the Suns are effectively doing for them is they're swallowing Jan Mahimi. He has 2 years left on his deal, which isn't a huge ask when you're giving up Tyson Chandler in the process and you don't necessarily know what you have in Chris or Bender at this point. They're giving up their own first-round pick. They're giving up Josh Jackson, but they're also getting Toronto's first-round pick and John Wall, who would be super interesting with Devin Booker. The one thing I will say, and you can tell me whether this trade is, I'm assuming it's a... no one's going to like a trade when you, not everyone at least, when you're dealing a superstar. But the thing to think about for the Suns, they do seem desperate to get more star power. General manager Ryan McDonough said that they're going to be aggressive this offseason with their cap space. If you max out Devin Booker, whose new deal is going to kick in the same season that Wall's extension kicks in, which is 2019-2020, you start out by paying $65 million a year to John Wall and Devin Booker. And assuming Booker gets increases, that number's only going to go up. And so all of a sudden, what is that going to be in the year when you're paying a 32-year-old John Wall $46.2 million and Booker is either in the last year of his deal or maybe he's opted out and you have to re-sign him? We're probably talking about $80 million for those two players or something close to it.
That is a tough pill to swallow, but the way you laid out that trade, it makes sense to me.
I'd do it if I was the Wizards, if that's the question here. I would do it for them.
Yeah, I honestly think the biggest, the toughest one is probably Phoenix, and it's just for the last thing that you said there, just thinking about how much money you would have committed to two players. But I do agree that the idea of a John Wall, Devin Booker backcourt is really intriguing. I just, how do you sufficiently surround it when you've got that much money committed to those two? And it's the same problem that just about every team's going to run into here in the next few years. Everybody's going to have max players, but
what would help them, I guess, is you have Toronto's pick, you have the Heat's pick this year. You still have that 2021 Heat pick. Maybe one of Chris or Bender hits, you have TJ Warren. You would still need shooting and that's, but you're not giving up a shooter in this trade, unless you're talking about who you're going to draft this year. What would be interesting is I couldn't send Jan Mahimi to the Nets just because they already have Mozgov And maybe they'd be, if you're going to get that top end pick, maybe you let the Suns keep Dudley and you send Mahimi to Brooklyn and that trade still works. But that would just be something to explore. I'm with you though. I would have the most pause. I would do it in a heartbeat for Brooklyn. I would do it with some thought for the Wizards. I'd have pause for the Suns, but I also think when you're getting the best player in any deal, that it's a lot easier
to take. Yeah, there's an inherent value in that for sure. Okay, I had one number on this Wizards lineup before we move on. And you'll like this because it's one of the random stat lines that you got dinged for in the reviews. here's the players with a 25-plus assist percentage and a 600-plus true shooting percentage this season. James Harden, LeBron James, Chris Paul, Nikola Jokic, Kyrie Irving, Kyle Lowry, Darren Collison. That's the first one I think some people might be surprised by. And then the last one is Tomas Satoransky. 25-plus assist percentage, 600-plus shooting or true shooting percentage. I think he's quietly had a very, very good season.
I don't even think that's very quietly. It's just, and that's true. What's really great for them is they only have to pay him $3 million next year.
Yeah, it's so front offices have to just celebrate when stuff like that hits.
You want to bring us to the next one? Number eight.
I love this one. It's the all-bench lineup from the Toronto Raptors. Fred VanVleet, DeLon Wright, CJ Miles, Pascal Siakam, and Jakob Poeltl. 468 possessions, 20.9 net rating for a lineup score of 97.81. To me, this is like one of the biggest points to be made for Dwayne Casey's Coach of the Year candidacy. The way that one Toronto has developed these young guys into, you know, not just rotation players, but I think a lot of these guys could start on a bunch of teams in the league. And it's mostly in-house development with guys like VanVleet and Poeltl and DeLon Wright. I mean, Siakam, really the only one that CJ Miles is the only free agent acquisition in this bunch. So there's that. And then just the fact that he's trusted them and allowed them to play so much together and to develop this chemistry as a second unit. There's always the question of how much does a bench really matter when you get into the playoffs. And I think that might be tested this year, maybe as much as it ever has, but in terms of regular season and just how good this bench has been, this has been one of my favorite sort of under the radar storylines. And maybe it's not under the radar, just like Satoransky's maybe not a quiet season, but I've definitely enjoyed the Raptors bench all year long.
My stat on this is I still find it crazy, and I've looked it up probably a bunch of times since the middle of the season. This lineup is the Raptors' second most used lineup overall, and that's just incredible.
That is crazy. Yeah.
And it's outscoring opponents by 21.3 points per 100 possessions overall, which is second best in the league among 57 lineups who have played at least 175 minutes. And I'm not even going to say the one that's in front of them because we're actually going to talk about them at the end of this podcast, but that's an all bench unit. They're just ahead of that lineup we just talked about for Houston, which made number 10. They're ahead of that. That's incredible to me. They have an assist rate of 67.8, true shooting percentage above 61. Their offensive rebounding percentage is solid. They don't grab a lot of defensive rebounds, but that's fine. They just, their offensive rating with these five too is almost 120. That's just nuts.
Do they have they don't have steal percentage on NBA.com, do they?
No.
Dang. Cause that would have been interesting to see. I shouldn't have called that out cause I knew it wasn't there, but I'm going to try and find that somewhere else at some point because DeLon Wright and Fred VanVleet, I think a big part of what makes them so tough defensively is the way that they just kind of ball hawk. So hoopstats.com has some bench stats. And it's not this lineup specifically, but they do lead the NBA in steals per game from a bench. And it's 4 a game from Toronto's bench. So this unit is getting them extra possessions. The stat that I found on this one, Lowry and DeRozan, when they're both on the floor, they're outscoring opponents by 7.9 points per 100 possessions. When VanVleet and Wright are on the floor, they're outscoring opponents by 18.4 points per 100 possessions. Now, obviously, Van Vliet and Wright are facing backups a lot more often than Lowry and DeRozan. But like you said, this is what was the minutes qualifier you had on that stat that you gave?
175.
This is the second most used lineup for Toronto. So that being the case, those two have definitely played against starters at points this season. And for Toronto to be killing people to this degree when their starters aren't on the floor, I think that makes them even more dangerous as we sort of head into the playoffs.
And it's really, this isn't related to the lineup exactly, but Casey has shown an inclination to go with Dellen Wright alongside DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry. And
yeah, I looked those up too, and those are the net ratings on those duos are all stellar.
They're absolutely absurd, and especially the one with it, they've been more inclined to go with Van Vliet, who has played more. He's fourth in crunch time minutes for the Raptors, so that's a lineup that they go to, or a three man combination that they go to end a lot of games. And it's been okay defensively. DeRozan, Lowry, Van Vliet, 105.2 defensive rating, and I think that's an accomplishment when you're going to have both DeRozan and Lowry guarding up positions. Their offensive rating is almost 112, and so that's just that's valuable that you can use a guy like Fred Van Vliet in that type of lineup, because he's not. It would make more sense to use Dellen Wright because he's taller and longer, but that lineup, Lowry, DeRozan, Dellen Wright, it's still been good. But it hasn't been, the defense has been better, but the offense isn't nearly as potent, and the net rating is just, it's slightly less, plus 4.1 points per 100 possessions. The Raptors have a lot of options, but I'm really, you said this when you were talking, I'm wondering if their identity, which has been so valuable in the regular season, is almost going to betray them in the postseason, because can you put this second unit lineup against starter-heavy combinations from some of the East's best teams time and time again? And if you can't, where are you paring down? You really can't cut Van Vliet's minutes, and you don't necessarily have to because he can play with DeRozan and Lowry, but that means you're cutting Wright's minutes. Can you really trim down Siakam's minutes when he's probably going to be important to how you defend LeBron? I really want to see more of the Ibaka-Siakam combination in the playoffs if they have to face a Love LeBron front court. Can you really sit Poeltl when he's been a better rim runner and offensive rebounder this year than Jonas Valanciunas, who's been absolutely spectacular himself? And then even just cutting CJ Miles' minutes is risky when you're the Raptors. Yes, you're shooting more threes, but you rank in the bottom half of efficiency from beyond the arc. So Dwayne Casey's going to have a lot of tough choices to make in the postseason. I'm interested to see how he handles them.
You know what's it's interesting? The one, you know, if I had to pick one guy whose minutes I could cut, and they might need to cut more than that, it might be Anunoby, who's actually been the starter for most of the season. Because I think a lot of those minutes that he eats up at the three can be played by DeRozan or Dellen Wright. But then you alluded to it. They're going to have to face LeBron at some point, and you need as many bodies as you can to sort of throw at him. And I think Anunoby is certainly a prime candidate for that. But if I had to trim the rotation down, and we'll see if Casey actually does this or not, he might be the first guy on the chopping block for me.
And it's amazing. And yeah, I was only talking strictly of who are you going to cut minutes wise from the bench. So it gets ridiculously difficult if you're starting to talk about starters. The other thing is we haven't even mentioned Norman Powell's name, which is just,
he might not even play.
Right. I mean, which is incredible on so many levels, because one, he's been a breakout candidate basically every year of his career. He was always that guy in the offseason.
Like the face of that.
Right.
I don't know what to call it, their bench or their, to me, it always felt like they were building something behind the starters, and he was sort of the face of that for a couple of years. And he's certainly not anymore.
Which is just, I mean, it's troubling because you just signed him, and I think they're going to look to move him, or maybe even Ibaka, who is just, his shooting off the catch is plunged for more than half the season at this point now, because you're not going to want to lose Fred Van Vliet in free agency, and yet you're already just going to be up against the tax by doing nothing to your roster. And unless you really push the Cavs, or unless you beat the Cavs, I don't know that the Raptors would be willing to dive into the luxury tax to keep this core together.
Kind of reminds me a little bit of when Eric Bledsoe had his mini breakout as Chris Paul's backup for the Clippers. And I think there was some talk back then of how do you let this guy go? But they just had to. It'll be interesting to see if Toronto can keep Van Vliet.
Do you think they could move Norman Powell?
I mean, look, I've got him pulled up. Or yeah, I thought I did. Yeah, I do. He's got, oh man, he has a new contract kicking in next year. I forgot about that.
4 and 42.
About
$10
million a year for the next 4 years. 9.4 to be a little bit more exact for next season. Oh man, you could probably talk somebody into it. I don't know if, would you have to attach a sweetener to him, you think? Like a second round pick or something? I don't know. I mean, has he been that bad?
No, if you have to attach a sweetener and I'm them, I'd probably just keep him. He's still on the right side of 25, right? So,
yeah.
But that's an interesting dilemma because you just signed him and I don't think, maybe they're willing to pay the tax, who knows, and they'll have next season to get under it if they just kind of dive into tax territory before the year, but that's going to be an interesting predicament for them, and a lot of it probably depends on how they finish the year in the playoffs. They're going to trade somebody, though. That's my prediction. I don't know who it's going to be at this point. I think they would like it to be Ibaka.
I was just going to say, if you can move Ibaka, I think that would be the prime one to do.
I just don't know where to – I would love to see him in Portland, but now with the emergence of Zach Collins and you have Nurkic is going to be a free agent and so is Ed Davis, is he really – maybe if the Raptors might even take back Myers Leonard in that deal because it's just less money and they're trying to duck the tax, but – I don't know if you can, unless you think that he's going to be an upgrade defensively over Nurkic in your defensive system, and then he gives you another pick and pop option, I don't know that Portland would consider it.
It's that same old problem we have with big guys, like every time we talk trades. It's hard to find.
And he's even, Ibaka's supposed to be one of the exceptions. He's just not, his athleticism is waning, and now that you've seen his shooting suffer, he does look more comfortable operating off the dribble, which is big, but his efficiency kind of needs to follow that comfort first before I think you can even consider him a trade commodity.
Yeah, and it's nice to have a big who can shoot and stretch out a little bit, but ideally you would want him to be able to rebound and block some shots from time to time still, and that stuff is just falling off a cliff for him.
100%, and he's just not as switchy as some of the other bigs today.
No, I agree.
That brings us to number 7, which isn't a surprising lineup, but I will say there's a chance we might not see this lineup again for the year. It is the Boston Celtics, Kyrie Irving, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, Al Horford, Aaron Baines. They've played 701 possessions, net rating from cleaning the glass of 14.1 for a lineup score of 98.84. This, I'm not even like kind of sort of surprised to see this unit here. They've been great. They were even better at the beginning of the season. Their defense has been spectacular, like basically every single Celtics lineup. It is almost, it's not funny, but when you look at the personnel that the Celtics have, that the lineup of theirs that shows up, not only on this list, but this high, is the one that runs dual big men. And I think that speaks more than anything to Al Horford's versatility, because he's just... I mean, you watch him, and this is part of the reason why his defensive...
But he doesn't score enough, Dan.
Oh, God, don't even get me started. And again, his defensive rebounding isn't good, and I don't think it would be great even if you camped him out in the paint, but when you watch how much time he spends on the perimeter guarding, it makes so much sense. And the other thing I really like about him is he's just one of the few bigs in the league that tries to get back and contest transition opportunities. I love him for that. And this unit, perhaps why it's also so effective too, is since you have Baines, it does help you with the rebounding a little bit. They aren't a great offensive rebounding unit, but their defensive rebounding rate is at 82.6, which is a solid mark.
Yeah, I was very salty about Utah losing to the Celtics last night when they didn't have Kyrie Irving and Al Horford and Gordon Hayward and Marcus Smart and Marcus Morris. but they had Baines, Brown, and Tatum who were in this lineup. And Brown and Tatum alone, I mean, that's obviously tons of reason for optimism. And the point I was starting to make is it seems like Brad Stevens can roll out like any five NBA or even borderline NBA guys and get them to play smart, cohesive defense. I mean, they were nightmarish defensively for stretches in that game. And they went zone for portions of it, then it just completely flummoxed Utah. They had no idea what to do. So they can give you multiple looks. I mean, it's not just one defensive system that they throw at you. Baines specifically, so I looked this up before we started recording. When Horford and Baines are on the floor, and I want to check to see before I give this what – so they still have the number one defense. I know that. I just want to be sure where they're at. They're allowing 101.2 points per 100 possessions. When Baines and Horford are on the floor, they're allowing 94.1. Just not even close to any other team's defense. When Baines, Horford, and Jaylen Brown are all on the floor, it's 93.1. And Baines, regardless of who he's sharing the floor with, it's 96.3. So it's, you mentioned the fact that they play some too big lineups sometimes, and Baines, to sort of cover all of Horford's weaknesses, the rebounding and just sort of banging down low, and then Horford can cover what Baines can't do and defend on the perimeter, like you said. Defensively, this team is just a nightmare. I still don't think, obviously, if they don't get Kyrie Irving back, they don't have really any shot to contend. But regardless of who's in that lineup, when the playoffs start, they are not going to be fun to play. Even if they get knocked out in the first round by like the Heat or the Wizards or something because they're so banged up, they are going to make a series out of that just because, it, like I said, it doesn't matter who's out there. He's going to get them to defend.
Yeah, for the first 43, 45 minutes, it almost just doesn't matter. And even that game against the Jazz might be a perfect example. Maybe they take us by surprise then too, because Brad Stevens, out of that timeout, the Celtics drew up that hell of a play, and that was one heck of a pass from Shane Larkin. It was like this hook pass. I don't know why so many Jazz players were collapsing on Shane Larkin in the first place. But and to this point, for the first, let's say, between 43, 45 minutes of the game, this, the core of this lineup, it doesn't matter who you use as the point guard. Terry Rozier has played 68 minutes with this group instead of Kyrie Irving. The Celtics have a 119 offensive rating, 87.9 defensive rating during that time. Marcus Smart, 43 minutes as the point guard with the other four, 114.2 offensive rating, 99 defensive rating. Shane Larkin has only made one appearance and played 12 minutes with the other four, but it's just 143 offensive rating, 68.6 defensive rating. So they're well coached. Brad Stevens, if the Celtics take the number one seed from the Raptors, and they have two games left against Toronto coming up, so if they win those and they steal first place in the East, we're really going to have – Dwayne Casey's still my pick right now, but Brad Stevens, I don't know how you would pick against him at that point.
If they pulled that off, it would have to be Stevens in a runaway.
It would.
Especially if they beat him twice down the stretch. That's – I didn't even realize they were close enough to take it back.
Three games after that win last night, I believe. So,
yep, three games.
You have two of them right there with Toronto left. If you have that's to win both.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a lot of distance to make up, but having two games against Toronto will certainly help. At some point, they've won five in a row now. At some point, you would think not having Kyrie Irving will catch up to them, but if... Again, like you said, if it doesn't, I don't know how you vote against Brad Stevens.
That's kind of a hellacious stretch for them, too. They play on Saturday. They host Toronto. That's being shown on NBA TV for some reason. I don't know why that's not like... Oh, because of the Final Four that night. That makes sense. And then Tuesday, they have Milwaukee in Milwaukee. And then on Wednesday, they travel to face Toronto.
That is rough.
It almost... That game's on ESPN. I wonder if... If they don't beat Toronto on Saturday, I could see them punting on the second game versus the Raptors. But yeah. I wonder, even if they win...
Well, they tried to punt last night and they still won. So.
Yeah, that's true. So they might try to punt anyway. Yeah, it doesn't even matter. So the second night of a back-to-back this late in the season, they know that number two is locked up for them at this point. But that'll be... I almost want them to beat Toronto on Saturday just because that would make Wednesday crazy.
More dramatic for sure, yeah. Did I do the last one?
No, that was me that just did that one.
All right, number six. Ricky Rubio, Donovan Mitchell, Joe Ingles, Jay Crowder, and Rudy Gobert, Utah Jazz. That lineup has played 310 possessions. It has a net rating of 32.9. I wonder what that is now after the Celtics game. But their lineup score is 101.99. This lineup has worked basically from the moment Quinn Snyder tried it. I don't know. It just – Favors and Gobert has worked for most of the season. It was bad at the beginning. But you see instantly why Quinn Snyder wants to go with small ball four when he puts Jay Crowder out there. Even with Crowder not really hitting shots for Utah, just the fact that defenses have to respect him out there, the fact that he can put the ball on the floor and have a little drive and dish game going, there's just an extra layer that he can provide offensively, and it just seems like it makes the Jazz a little bit more difficult to defend. He's also a little bit more switchy than Derek Favors, and I say that acknowledging that Favors, I think, is one of the most mobile big guys the NBA has around the three-point line. I mean, he can switch about as well as anybody his size, but Crowder can certainly guard down a few more positions a little bit easier. So this is one that makes sense to me too. The fact that it's only, you know, been around since Crowder was traded to the Jazz is kind of crazy that they were able to climb this high up onto this list. But if you watch it play, it totally makes sense that it's here.
I'm 100% with you on everything, and I love the way the Jazz look when they run smaller. Crowder's defense has been a lot better since he went to Utah, and his shooting is really just not stabilized too much just yet. But if it does, this lineup is going to be incredibly dangerous. I'm still not used to watching Ricky Rubio pull up for jumpers. That's been an experience.
It's been like a month and a half of good shooting now, which is like hard to wrap my head around.
Joe Ingles, an understated shooter too. He's their most efficient pull up shooter. You don't even need to filter it. He's just their most efficient pull up shooter in terms of effective field goal percentage. And this stat I found interesting too. So 223 players are averaging at least 20 minutes per game in a minimum of 10 appearances since February 1st. So that sounds like a mouthful, but we're talking about 223 players. Ingles is tied for 12th in overall effective field goal percentage of that group. And that time since February 1st, he had that slump. Wasn't there like a week or two where he just wasn't shooting really well? And it's really impressive that he's there, because you look at comprising, it's really 13 players. Steven Adams, Ryan Anderson, DeAndre Jordan, Clint Capella, even Dwight Powell. Gobert is number two, by the way, on this list. It's a bunch of big guys because they're supposed to be there. Shout out to Mo Harkless, who just underwent surgery, but he is first on this list. 68.8 effective field goal percentage since February 1st. But to be among wings like Kyle Korver, who's just this flamethrower off the catch and coming around screens, to be with Durant, that's a testament to Ingles. And it also says a lot, by the way. Josh Hart, who hasn't played in a bit, he's tied for fourth with Capella on this list. So he's been fun to watch.
That's
this
crazy. I wonder what Ingles is season long. And I'm going to take big men out of this equation just because you got me curious. So I'm looking at players who've taken at least 100 threes this season, sorted by effective field goal percentage. Where do you think Ingles lands?
Top three.
Four. So you were close.
Damn.
There's only six guys with an effective field goal percentage over 60 in this group. Kyle Korver's is 63, which is insane. Stephen Curry, 61.8. Reggie Bullock, 60.8. Joe Ingles, 60.8. So I guess technically you were right on the money because he's tied for third. Joe Harris, 60.6. And Anthony Tolliver, 60 even.
Do you think?
And this one's really fun. Carl Anthony Towns, 59.9.
Carl Anthony Towns is nuts.
He really is. Go ahead. What were you going to ask?
Do you think that Joe Ingles, one of my issues with the Jazz when you look at playoff basketball specifically, is they're already still reliant on a rookie in Donovan Mitchell who hasn't, when you look at his offense, he's been pretty good on defense this year, but when you look at his offense lately, he's kind of fallen off. And who do you go to down the stretch? You don't have, that's kind of where you sacrifice by getting rid of Rodney Hood. He wasn't efficient. Rodney Hood wasn't efficient, but he was used to pulling up. You don't play Alec Burks anymore. Can Ingles be that guy?
They're still going to go to Mitchell.
I'm as the alternative to, like, if Mitchell's because there are going to come times you look at it when defense is zero in on Kyrie Irving in Boston and you have to go to Tatum or Brown.
he is in some ways. I think if there's somebody that's going to like commandeer a possession and try and go get a bucket,
Ricky Rubio.
Yeah, I was going to say Ricky Rubio, which is that's an appropriate response. It's kind of scary. Even as good as he's been for the last couple months, it's you still sort of shudder to think that he's going to be that guy
in the postseason, which he's never played in before.
Yeah. And maybe he'll find even another level in the postseason. Who knows? I would like it to be Joe Ingles. I prefer him running pick and rolls to Rubio generally. I just feel like he's a little bit safer with the ball. I don't know if the numbers back me up on that, but that's been a running theme for the Jazz all season, really, is who can you go to for sort of from scratch offense after Donovan Mitchell? And it's not a lot of nights. It's not apparent that there's really anybody. So it's a very real concern you bring up.
You realize that this wouldn't be an issue if Rudy Gobert would just develop a pull-up floater already.
Well, I need him to start taking like 25-foot threes, 30-foot threes.
Just have him camp. They just need to have him camp out in the corner for an entire quarter and see how defenses react.
Yeah, that would be fun. I mean, they're trying the Derek Favors three, so have at it.
Do you know what they should stop trying to make happen? Minutes with Dante Exum and Ricky Rubio on the court.
It's only they've only done it for, I think, 9 minutes.
It's 11 now, and they have a net rating of -34.7. But they've appeared it's small doses.
If they play like 5 good minutes, that net rating could completely flip.
It could, but stop. I'm just right now. Stop trying to make it happen.
I'm with you. It's not.
It's crazy that Quinn Snyder just seems to. It's almost like he has instant regret because they've played 11 minutes across 5 games.
He gets instant regret like the moment he puts Dante Exum into any game. It's not just that lineup.
Yeah, you've talked to me about like his quick hook.
He can't stand Dante Exum. But I like that he's at least willing to try it.
In that Celtics game, they had both of them on the floor with Mitchell, right, for a tick?
Oh, that's what's 9 minutes. Yeah, when Mitchell, Exum, and Rubio are all together, because I just looked that up this morning. I'm pretty sure it was 9 minutes. If Exum's going to play in the playoffs or down the stretch, he might have to play more off the ball. They've got to find some way to get him more minutes, though, because he's been a spark plug for them the last couple games, and he's been way better than Royce O'Neal for the last, like, 2 or 3 weeks. So they've got to find some way to get him on the floor. I just, like you said, it's maybe not with Rubio.
Would you like a random fun fact about the Jazz?
Yes, I would.
They play at the 4th fastest pace in crunch time in the league.
Where are they overall?
25th on the season.
And their clutch net rating is good, right?
They are plus 3.6 per 100 possessions right now, which is fine.
About the same as their overall then.
Yeah, their offensive rating is 108.2 in crunch time. So it's just – which there are better crunch time offenses, but when you look at 108.2, it's just steady because the Jazz are like a pretty good offensive team, or at least for long stretches during the regular season. That floored me, though, when I saw that they were
fourth in pace. I know, that is weird that they could – they just sort of flip that switch when they get into crunch time.
It's not like crunch time offenses are typically slower. They're fourth at 104.18 possessions per 48 minutes. Like, it's a small sample, but at the same time, it's a 106-minute sample, so it's clearly a trend. I just found that. I was floored when I saw it.
It's definitely surprising. All right, you want to do number five?
Yes, number five comes from the Minnesota Timberwolves. It is Tyus Jones, Andrew Wiggins, Jimmy Butler, Taj Gibson, Karl Anthony Towns. They have played 505 possessions together and have a net rating of 25.3 for a lineup score of 127.77. They just, this Jazz lineup that was number six wasn't even close. They've been good. And this was a lineup that people were clamoring for the Timberwolves to use even when Jeff Teague was healthy. It was maybe we should just start Tyus type of deal. And that's a little bit, you know, that's still kind of out there, but they've been so good, especially when you look at their offense rating is 118.3, but their defense has been 94.9. Tyus Jones has been a really good defender this year, which is kind of why I didn't understand when they lost to the Grizzlies that he was playing under 6 minutes. That really just did not make any sense to me, and
0 0 7.
Even Teague seemed pissed about it afterwards. He was basically like, yeah, Tibbs should realize that we have a bench.
And he does not. Tyus Jones is currently 12th in the NBA overall in real plus minus at ESPN.
What's been interesting, though, is over the last 10 games, so Jimmy Butler hasn't been a part of this, Tibbs has only played Jones with Wiggins, Towns, and Gibson for 11 minutes over the last 10 games through 8 appearances. They've been bad. Their defense has been 160.7, which speaks to how important Jimmy Butler is. But to just abandon that model entirely...
He's kind of abandoning, maybe not abandoning, but Jones's minutes just individually have been going down over the course of the season too, which
Derrick
is
Rose. Hilarious. He's not healthy at the moment.
He played 18.1 minutes a game before the All-Star break, which even then, probably not enough. 16 minutes a game post-All-Star, and in the last 10, 15.6. So just steadily going down. And you look at a Timberwolves box score just about any night they play, there's like three or four starters without fail every time who have more than 40 minutes. It's starting to drive me a little bit crazy, and I'm not even a Timberwolves fan, but I look at guys like Luol Deng and Joakim Noah and Derrick Rose, and I'm legitimately scared for Towns and Wiggins and even Butler.
Who's so gone in 2019.
That crazy stat line that Towns had last night, it was like 56 and 15. That's awesome to see. I couldn't pry my eyes away from 41 minutes against the Hawks. I'm just so worried for these guys' knees, and hopefully they survive their stint with Tibbs.
You don't want to see them rush Butler back either.
I know. I'm really worried about that too. When you bring a guy back before he's healthy, you can aggravate the injury they already have. You can bring on more injuries. I'm worried. I said that like four or five times. I'm very worried about these guys.
As you should be. But if they get Butler back, they will be interesting in the playoffs. Just because you put Teague instead of Jones in this lineup, it's still going to work. I don't even know the Derrick Rose lineup instead of them. I don't need to see that even kind of. I'll pass. Like, No thanks.
That's going to be hilarious when he's playing like 25 minutes in a playoff game.
Will he even be healthy enough to do that is the question.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't.
Tibbs will like shove his wheelchair out there personally.
Does it surprise you at all that obviously it doesn't surprise you at all that this lineup is here, right? Because this was like a talking point.
For sure. Yeah. Number four, we're back to the Raptors, and this is the Raptor starters. Another one that's probably not very surprising. Kyle Lowry, DeMar DeRozan, OG Anunoby, Serge Ibaka, and Jonas Valanciunas. I don't know if I don't have a ton more to add to this beyond the Raptors discussion we already had. Obviously, this is a different lineup. But I, to me, it's just the fact that they're 10 deep, I think, is one of their biggest strengths this season.
OG Anunoby just taking Norman Powell's spot and never looking back.
That was definitely interesting, for sure.
What is probably a concern for them, they've played five times over the Raptors' last 10 games together, and this unit has a defensive rating of 117.2. It hasn't mattered because their offense has been even better because, of course, their offense has been even better. But Anunoby can defend wings. It's fine, but there's still that Ibaka, Valanciunas front court. That, to me, that's just... I don't know. I'm not in love with it. And Anunoby's done a good job kind of neutralizing it for much of the season, but that'll be something that gets tested in the playoffs as well. And these three, when they're on the court together for the season, the Raptors have a defensive rating of 103.4. And even just the overall numbers, when you look at Ibaka and Valanciunas, isolate that, still 106 defensive rating overall for the season. And that's good if those are the two bigs you're going to roll out, in my opinion. But it'll be interesting to see how this lineup holds up defensively into the playoffs. And if they're going to let up a bunch of points, that might be where you see them have a quicker hook and throw Van Fleet in there for Valanciunas, and you roll with Ibaka at the five and Anunoby at the four. That would be a really interesting look for them.
I remember what I was going to say about this group. Jonas Valanciunas is averaging a career low in minutes. Did you realize that?
Yes, I did, actually.
Career highs in points and rebounds per minute. I think he's played a little bit more in crunch time than he did in years past, right? Or is that a development that did not hold?
No, he's played more than in years past, but he's still not among there. I think he's fifth or sixth in total crunch time minutes. He might be sixth because of Van Fleet.
And I kind of you got to get Poeltl on the floor. Poeltl, my umlaut pronunciation comes and goes. And they've got so many different options at the five, and you already laid out some of them. But that was certainly interesting to me. He is one of only 5 guys in the league this season with a defensive rebounding percentage over 30 and a block percentage over 3. So in the minutes that he's out there, he's still very productive.
The lineup that I was talking about before, the Raptors have not gone to much this season. 37 minutes in 8 appearances, and that's Ananobi, DeRozan, Ibaka, Lowry, Van Vliet. They have a 117.9 offensive rating, but the defensive rating creeps up to about close to 110. The net rating then is still good, but the assist percentage on that lineup is 44.8, which isn't surprising because Ananobi and Ibaka are essentially non-passers, or at least non-essential passers, but they have an 88.2 defensive rebounding percentage. That's a good number. Well, it's a great number overall, but it's fantastic when Ibaka is your center.
Yeah,
That to me would be, maybe that's one of their counters to when Cleveland plays with Kevin Love and LeBron James as the 4-5. I don't know. That'll be interesting to watch for them. It might have to be a counter if they face the Celtics at all when they don't have Aaron Baines on the floor because they have all these wings.
And Toronto has some options they can go to. I think that's definitely one of them.
Number 3, and we should pour one out for this lineup because we will not see it again. It comes from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Russell Westbrook, Andre Robertson, Paul George, Carmelo Anthony, and Steven Adams. They've played 1,086 possessions. 14.5 net rating, lineup score 157.47. And I said that we wouldn't be seeing this lineup again. I was going to use the qualifier this season, but there's a really good chance that we just don't ever see this lineup again if Paul George leaves in free agency.
Yeah, you're totally right. And it is sad. I do feel like pouring one out is probably appropriate because this is a very, very good lineup. Like you said, 14.5 net rating. A lot of people were talking about Paul George for Defensive Player of the Year earlier this season. But I think a lot of that love probably should have been going to Andre Roberson. Season long now, in the minutes that he was on the floor, OKC was allowing just 96.4 points per 100 possessions. So again, the Celtics' league-leading defense is 101.2. So when Roberson was on the floor, OKC was comfortably ahead of that. In the minutes when he's been off the floor this season, OKC is allowing 107.7 points per 100 possessions, which would be in the bottom third of the league, or close to the bottom third. Just a massive difference in defensive ability for this team when he's not on the floor. And I think that's stabilized a little bit in the last couple of weeks. They've kind of figured out how to defend without him. But in a playoff series, it's going to be really tough for them to win more than – I think they could probably win a first-round series, but their ceiling is kind of capped to me without that sort of linchpin player in Roberson.
This specific lineup, when you have both Anthony and Russell Westbrook on the floor, has a 95.9 defensive rating, is absurd to me. And I looked this up before we podcasted. Paul George and Andre Robertson, when they play together, the Thunder allow 94.2 points per 100 possessions. That's even more nuts than Robertson's overall impact. Those two together, that's why the Thunder, even when they didn't look like they were at their best, even when the offense wasn't necessarily humming, you thought that, hey, maybe they could really throw a wrench in the plans of Houston or even Golden State. With George and Robertson, they have so many different defensive looks. They can cover up effectively for Carmelo Anthony. You can switch a bunch of things if you put Patrick Patterson at the five and have those two on the floor. it can get really crazy if you remove Melo and you had Jeremy Grant or Josh Huestis in it. Those are things that they didn't really experiment too much with before Robertson went down. But that was a heck of a defensive duo. It might have been the best defensive duo in the league. I'm trying to think of where there would be a better one. And I don't think that...
Maybe some of those Celtics ones we threw out earlier. Just but the, that would be my only...
Maybe guess. Also... I don't know if Simmons is there yet. I was going to say Embiid Simmons or Embiid Covington. That might be one that's worth talking about.
Close, yeah.
So definitely top three. That would be, I would rank them no lower than third. And right now I'd be inclined to put them just because Robertson and George, they can defend. Robertson can defend basically 1 through 4 and George can go 2 to 4.
Yeah. And I think if you're just talking like subjectively, who's your best sort of two-man defensive combo, they would absolutely be in that conversation. Number two,
I'm another about to shit on Tom Thibodeau for this one.
Another Timberwolves lineup. Jeff Teague, Andrew Wiggins, Jimmy Butler, Taj Gibson, Karl-Anthony Towns. Of course, this is their starting lineup for most of the season. It's played 2,174 possessions, net rating of 7.4. So volume is, I mean, that's a good net rating, but volume is definitely carrying the day for this lineup. And they have a lineup score of 160.88. Before we started recording, I wanted to look up which two-man combinations have played the most minutes. And to no one's surprise, they are both part of this lineup. Gibson Wiggins leads the league in
minutes. I never would have guessed that.
And Wiggins-Towns is fifth. And I actually thought there would be more Minnesota duos in the top five. There's some OKC ones in between them. But, I'm sorry for the young developing legs of guys like Andrew Wiggins and Karl-Anthony Towns.
Well, I guess it makes sense because now Butler and Teague have both missed time this year. So Gibson and Wiggins certainly make sense because you need that safety net for him. Now, this lineup, 2,174 possessions... That is the most possessions any lineup in the league has played. And not only is it the most, but in second place is Charlotte's Kemba Walker, Nick Batum, Kit Gilchrist, Marvin Williams, Dwight Howard lineup, which is now up to 2,003 possessions. So there's a 171 possession gap.
It's like two games worth of...
Okay, and Jimmy Butler has missed the past 14 games.
Oh my gosh.
That is just... absolutely reckless, irresponsible. If I'm Jimmy Butler, why are you staying in Minnesota? Here's the catch 22. Who wants to sign Jimmy Butler in 2019 after he's played under Tom Thibodeau for another 2 years?
Yeah.
If he's even alive by then.
I really hope in like 5 years he's not in Luol Deng's shoes. Which seems like an extreme thing to say, but think about how good Luol Deng was when he played for he was in his prime with the Bulls.
Yeah, I mean, and even he perked up a bit when he was in Miami, but it wasn't there. Even when he was getting minutes from Los Angeles last season, it just wasn't, it's not there anymore. And
use your bench, Tibbs. Listen to your players.
He has to at some point, because this is, there comes a point, never mind players' health, but it's almost a fireable offense because why are you not trying different things when you're out there losing to the Memphis Grizzlies?
Yeah. Well, it has to have been a discussion at this point. When the players are speaking up about it in like post-game interviews and stuff, they have to have talked about it. Can we really trust this guy with these young players? I mean, they have one of the most talented young players in the history of the game in Karl-Anthony Towns. I think you want to take as much care of him as you possibly can. Yeah.
And what's crazy and how important that Jimmy Butler is, when Andrew Wiggins is on the court with Butler, the Wolves have a 103.8 defensive rating, which is above average. And when Wiggins is playing with Butler off the court, the Wolves have a 114.4 defensive rating.
Holy cow.
That was a fantastic
That's incredible.
Volume of this lineup is just, I can't. I honestly can't.
It's ridiculous. Yeah, I'm with you. Number one, that's yours, isn't it?
Oh, look at that. It is mine. And this one, I think we both, if you would have said which lineup is going to show up number one before we started all this, I think this would have been the pick for both of us, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I would have gone there.
It comes from, drum roll, hypothetically, the Philadelphia 76ers. Ben Simmons, J.J. Redick, Robert Covington, Dario Saric, Joel Embiid. They've played 1,222 possessions. Net rating of 21.1. That's a net rating of 21.1. Their lineup score is 257.84, almost a full 100 points in front of the second-place Timberwolves.
That's crazy.
That's ridiculous. Their distance that they have between them and second place is larger than the difference between second place and 20th place in these rankings, just for some context perspective. I know you I'm have thoughts you. About this lineup.
Not all that surprising. Like you said, it's been one of the best lineups in the league all season, basically. One knock on this, or one knock on Ben Simmons, I should say, for much of the season was, well, he can't really carry the day when Joel Embiid's off the floor. And the net rating does tumble quite a bit when Simmons plays without Embiid, but he's no longer a minus. When just Simmons and Embiid are on the floor, since January 1st, Philly's plus 20 per 100 possessions. They're plus 22 per 100 possessions since February 1st. When Simmons is on the floor without Embiid, they're plus 3.2 per 100 possessions since January 1st, and they're plus 6 per 100 possessions since February 1st. So they have figured out how to play without Embiid, too. I think a lot of people were worried about Philly in the playoffs because, yes, they have this dominant starting five, but as soon as you start taking a guy out here and there and putting some bench players in, are they going to fall apart in the playoffs? And maybe that still happens. They're an inexperienced team. But that bench has started to stabilize. And the fact that they can still comfortably outscore people when Joel Embiid is not on the floor, this team is starting to get really scary for playoff time. I would not be stunned if they made the conference finals and maybe even the finals. Is that crazy to say? Like, it would be a lot like the year that OKC made the finals, like seemingly 1 or 2 years too early to me.
I don't think that's crazy at all, because the biggest roadblock to them, to me, would just still be Cleveland because of LeBron.
I agree.
And they're only a half game behind the Cavs for third place. So if you get to a point where, if you're going to win the third seed and then you still don't that means you wouldn't have to face Cleveland until the Eastern Conference Finals. And you're going to have to go through, let's say, the Wizards and the Celtics. That's a doable path to get to the Conference Finals. And the Cavs will have had to face the Raptors by then. So maybe you're not even facing Cleveland in the Conference Finals.
Yeah, I'm thinking more and more every day, like, there is an outside chance that
they're the one.
The first year they kind of flipped the switch on the process, they might actually get to the finals, which is
right. They have, and so I looked this up the other day too, and I should probably see if it's changed, but they have the third best crunch time offense in the league. So this is a team that can win close games.
I actually just had that in a stat thread the other day. It's interesting because I think their fourth quarter net rating is still really bad. But somehow they can just sort of flip the switch in the really important moments. One thing I just looked up, because I was curious, Bellinelli has an individual net rating of 7.2 with the Sixers, and Ilyasova has an individual net rating of 7 with the Sixers. So adding those two guys, those two sort of veteran presences to stabilize the bench, maybe that's a big part of why that bench has been better lately, and that's maybe more reason to trust them a little bit in the playoffs is those two vets that they picked up.
Yeah, and again, the issue for them still, though, remains that you kind of have to have between 2 and 3 starters on the floor for them, but you were running it rattling off. It's fine in the playoffs. Yeah, and I mean, the biggest thing is, can they survive without Joel Embiid on the floor? And you were just rattling off all those numbers. The other one I have is, since February 1st, there are plus 13 points per 100 possessions with Robert Covington and Ben Simmons on the floor without Embiid. They're plus 23.6 with Embiid, because of course. But they've played within 100 minutes. So those three have logged 377 minutes together since February 1st. And then Covington and Simmons have played 278 on their own.
this is a team that's coming along, and if Fultz is the wild card to me, because he gives you the extra shot creator that you theoretically don't have, even though your offense in crunch time says you're fine. And now all of a sudden, if your lineups without Embiid are always going to include two of Simmons, Covington, or Fultz, you're on easy street.
Fultz has been really good as a playmaker.
Yeah, I mean, since he came back. The Celtics clearly lost that trade.
they've got a lot more going behind that starting lineup, but I mean, the point of this little segment is definitely that five-man lineup, and it has been dominant all season long, hasn't really wavered, and to me that makes them a dangerous squad in the playoffs. Do you have anything else you want to add?
No, I don't. My final question then before we wrap it up, and good thing we split this into two podcasts, by the way. Yeah. This was going to end up being a 2.5 hour exercise total. So do you think that Cleveland is going to hold on to the number 3 seed? They have a half-game hold over Philly, and Philly has the easiest schedule in the league. I know Joel Embiid suffered that facial contusion on Wednesday night, since we're recording this on Thursday, and the Sixers are about to play the Hawks and the Nets. I don't know that they need Embiid for games like those.
I'm going to say Philly gets number 3. And like you laid out earlier, that makes their road, or their potential road to the finals, even easier. I want to see who Cleveland has coming up real quick. They're against New Orleans, against Dallas, against Toronto, against Washington, at Philadelphia. So there could be something to play for there. At the Knicks, and then against the Knicks. So it's like kind of middle of the road, I think, for Cleveland's remaining schedule.
The winner of that Philly-Cleveland game, I think you could argue, is just going to be the 3 seed.
I was going to say, that'll be huge. Friday, April 6th. Cavs in Philadelphia. So that'll be a fun one to pay attention to.
Embiid is out.
Yeah, I think my officially what's out. That?
I did look that up. Embiid is officially out against the Hawks on Friday. But again,
facial contusion it's certainly better than a concussion or anything like that.
It said he cleared initial concussion protocol, and he was Snapchatting or Instagramming or whatever from the hospital. So
yeah, I bet you he'll be back in a couple games, if that. All right. Well, like you said, this was a good 2.5, almost 3 hours on NBA lineups. If you didn't listen to 25 to 11, obviously you can go back and find it in the podcast feed, whether you listen on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Blog Talk Radio, or you go and go to the NBA Math and find them. They're everywhere. Subscribe to the podcast, review, rate, share it with your friends. Let them know that we exist and brighten their lives by doing so. You can use that promo code that Dan shouted out earlier in the episode. It's BENO at the NBA Math Shop. You just go nbamath.com/shop, and you will find some really cool t-shirt designs that you cannot find anywhere else, and you'll get 15% off if you use that promo code. So go ahead and do that. And until next time, we leave you with the shout out to Beno Udrih.